Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Yeah, so the next time I asked for a ride, I didn't get one.
No, that's when you look at the other people and say, I meant to do that.
Yeah, I meant to.
Exactly. Well, yeah, that's what you do when your lights are on and they look at you. You just speed through the light and go on to some fake call somewhere, right?
Drive like hell. Hey, I want to start progressing into talking about your books, but I want to talk about your time on the Marshals. When you look back, what's like one of the most impactful cases or impactful investigations or things that you did? Because when we had Billy Sarukas on, we talked about the DC sniper. You guys do some just fantastic work. You've got some great technology. We talked earlier, Blair Dean, when he used to run the TOG, the Tactical Operations Group, some of the stuff you guys do with phones. And I mean, just amazing stuff. When you look back on it, what's one or two things that just really stick out to you and you think back and you go, I'm glad, maybe it wasn't the biggest case, but you look at it and you go, that one made a difference. I really like that one. Have you got one or two like that?
Yeah, sure. You know, it's interesting. And I'm actually in the book I'm working on now, I'm making a comparison to, you know, and one of the things I really liked about the Marshal Service is you could start your day working with all kinds of tech, especially in Alaska and North Idaho, working with all kinds of technical equipment. Back when I was starting, it was pagers and things like that. So now, and that's kind of a cool thing, is in the Clancy books, I could talk about pager technology and all that that we don't really use now, so it's not sensitive anymore. But working with phones and, you know, and computers and all kinds of stuff, and then 2 hours later, be tracking somebody boots on the ground through bear country up here and really have to do it the old way. And so I really like that. I kind of gravitated towards rural work because, yeah, we still use cell phone technology. We still use all that stuff, even in rural areas, as far as tracking people and even social media stuff. But we don't, we really have to rely on knowing how to physically man track and that sort of thing. So early on in my career, I really enjoyed the high tech, you know, using pagers, using cell phones when they came. I sat next to a guy in the academy who, he just a brilliant, brilliant deputy. Even back in 1991, he had a stack of papers about cell phone technology, and he realized back then this is the future of tracking fugitives. And so he worked with Blair and those guys. And I don't like to name their names because he's still kind of half in the business, but he's just a brilliant guy. And he helps me quite a bit with the Clancy's as well. So I really enjoyed those sorts of things. And the cases were many, but when I got to North Idaho, we had a case. Now, again, you guys mentioned Weaver and Ruby Ridge and all that. So that's the zeitgeist up there, the feeling, the kind of the anti-Fed and the animosity and stuff like that. But so we went into that, and then we had a guy that was wanted on he was just wanted on a federal parole warrant. So back then we had a lot more parole warrants, and then of course parole got abolished. But we still had a few people wanted on parole. Now it's all supervised release. And we like parole warrants because there was no court. You just arrested the guy and took him to prison. There, when you violated parole, you just went back to jail. There was no, you know, pass and go or anything. You just went to prison, not even the county jail. And this, the nearest, because they were property of the Bureau of Prisons as far as what the courts saw. So we were looking for this guy. His name was Farron Lovelace. And as we started investigating more, we learned that he was a suspect in kidnapping a Jewish couple across the state line into Spokane. He held them hostage in their own home for 3 days, 2 days maybe, but I think a couple of nights. And he had like fed their dogs and snuck up to their house and got in and held them hostage. And he had been in prison, then he jumped parole and then come over here. And he had a hit list of a bunch of feds he wanted to kill, and not just feds, but so we're learning all this little stuff on him that kind of blossomed out of this parole warrant. And we worked it for a number of months, but we started to learn that he was just really a bad guy. But as we got an informant involved and some other people, we learned that he was hiding up on a mountain. He had married a woman. He was in his late 30s, and he had married an older woman in her 60s. That had a son and a grandson, and she had a lot of, she had Social Security and stored food, and kind of a back before prepping was a thing, she was a prepper. And so he had basically gotten all her food, and he had his, because he was really living a life on the run, completely disconnected. He had no phone, no nothing. So they had moved, he had moved this teenage boy and this 60-year-old woman up into the mountains of North Idaho, and they built their encampment up there. And they had booby traps, they had fish hooks hanging from monofilament. He had you might recognize this if you've read the book there. He had split pieces of wood with shotgun shells up through the middle of them and buried all around for like homemade landmines and various booby traps around. And now imagine in that situation when I write a note to headquarters that says, hey, we got this guy and a woman and a teenage boy up on a mountain in North Idaho. We'd like to go get him. They said, not in a million years are you going to go up and have a gunfight on a mountain in North Idaho with a teenage boy and a woman and a fugitive. And so we had to come up with a lot of different plans. And it ended up that my partner who'd been working on it with me, this was back after the first World Trade Center bombings, and he was part of our special operations group. So we were protecting the judges back in New York. So he had to rotate out every few weeks and go back and help with the protective details. And so he was out of town, so it was me and the FBI, where they had helped work on the case because we all had to work together. And there was an FBI agent named Tom Norris, who's a Medal of Honor Medal of Honor recipient, I should say. Tommy Norris, he's the only FBI agent I ever met with a glass eye. He's the guy that saved Bat 21. So, I mean, just a phenomenal dude. And he mentored my oldest son. He's just a very unassuming, FBI let him get away with what he wanted to, 'cause he was a, you know, Medal of Honor recipient and really just a class act. So he was helping on it. So we came up with a plan to lure Farron off the mountain. And originally he had a bicycle, and we knew he would come down off this mountain. There was quite a hike up there, take his bicycle and maybe come into town once in a while for supplies. And so I came up with a plan to put a flashbang next to the bike, and we'd hide and we'd lure him down to the bicycle and then get him there. Headquarters said, nope, no flashbangs on a mountain. So we came up with another plan and Farron was super prejudiced, super white supremacist, super prejudiced. So we said, we sent our informant back up, and this is all not sensitive now because it's all come out in court, but we sent the informant back up, and he said, hey, there's a Hispanic gun dealer in town that wants to buy some guns, but he's got two white girls that he's pimping out in Priest River, Idaho, and you might want to come down and sell him some guns and take care of, you know, cleaning up the race a little bit. And, you know, Farron actually said, I'm going to come down and do that. I'm going to come down and I'm going to sell him some guns in air quotes and take care of this Hispanic guy that's pimping out white girls. And I mean, that's just the way his brain worked. And so we set up the time, and we had Boundary County deputy sheriffs and Bonner County deputy sheriffs and Tom Norris and I. And the plan was, when Farron came riding by on his bicycle, there's a long, long bridge outside Priest River, Idaho, that goes over Priest Lake. And we were going to pinch him in the middle of the bridge because we knew he was going to be armed. He had a hit list. And he had a violent past. And so Tommy was behind him, and I was coming up to meet him. And the idea was, when he got on the bridge, we'd get him pinched between our two cars and arrest him so nobody else was in danger. We would close off the bridge. Well, as Tom Norris got in behind him, he saw that he had a pistol in his hip pocket. He had a GP-100 pistol in his hip pocket and a little backpack on and a little, like a 10/22 rifle sawed off, sticking out the back of his backpack. And I mean, he's like the Wicked Witch of the West, you know, and riding on his bicycle towards town to meet this guy. And Tommy, I don't know what happened, whether he touched the gun or what, but Tom pulled up beside him and just bumped him off the road. So he went ahead and endoed and went into the ditch. And so I sped up there, and this all happened very fast. So he went into the ditch before he got onto the bridge. And so I was right there, and there was a Boundary County deputy right behind me in a marked unit. And so Tommy bailed out of his car. I bailed out of his car because of the way Tommy had to come around. The Boundary County deputy and I got there first, and we jumped on top, and the Boundary County deputy was huge. And I thought I was picking up Farron, but then Farron kind of lifted out of my hands, and then I lifted off the ground, and then we both went to the ground. Guns went everywhere, and we were able to, because of this very strong Boundary County deputy, I was able to get Farron handcuffed almost immediately. But while we're in this scrum to handcuff him, another car pulls over, and it's a nurse who thought there had just been a wreck. And so she, with the strength of 10 men, shoulders her way through and says, "I'm a nurse. I'm here to help." And we're like, "No, get, you know, this is a felon. Get out of the way." And she ended up kind of skidding on her knees. We got Farron handcuffed, and as I'm standing him up, you know, he's got grass in his face. And as I'm standing him up, as you do, you know, when somebody's handcuffed, I'm helping to his feet. He looked at me, and very clear-eyed and very calm, he said, "It is obvious to me that you're more racially pure than I am, or you never would have gotten me." Said, "Yeah, you need to watch your head. Get in the car." So I put him in the car. The Boundary County deputy, we put him in the Boundary County deputy's cage car. Everybody's sort of, you know, tidying up, talking to the nurse and all that. So I sat down in the, you know, kicked the door open. I'm sitting down in the back of this cage car with Farron Loveless, who's just a creepy, he just exudes creepiness. And he was really worried about this lady that he was married. "What are you guys going to do to her? You know, there's booby traps up there. I don't want her to get hurt. Don't shoot her, please." And we're like, "We're not aiming to shoot anybody. You're who we were after." And he said, "Well, I'll make you a deal. If you will not prosecute her," you know, I said, "Well, let's get your rights read. Let's get all this done." We got his rights read to him. There were witnesses, all that. And then he said, "If you don't prosecute her, I'll tell you about a murder that I did." I mean, okay. And this was dirt still falling off of him. And I said, "Okay." I mean, I don't think we're going to prosecute her anyway, but yeah, sure. Let's tell us about the murder. So he told us about another white supremacist that he thought was going to rat them out. And so he told about how he kidnapped this young kid. It turned out that one of the other guys from their outfit wanted this kid's wife. And so he said, "Farron, whack him." So Farron kept him hostage for a night at a cabin, pistol whipped him, knocked a front tooth out. And, then ended up taking him into the mountains and killing him. And Farron, we had to get permission to get him back out of jail and all that. And of course, because Farron was kind of running the show of where he was taking us, we were very careful mm-hmm. about, you know, getting somebody out of custody to take him to point A that we knew he knew where we were going. And he was guiding the shots down these remote logging roads. Sure enough, he took us right to the place where the body was buried. And this kid was, poor guy is shot in. He's another white supremacist, but shot in the back of the head, as Farron said. Well, it's really difficult to convict somebody just on that. They wanted some other corroboration besides I did it, here's the body and all that. So they wanted some other corroboration. So Bonner County, the Bureau, and I went out in front of the house, this cabin, and it was like an archaeological dig. And it was pea gravel. And this had been one whole winter and spring and now fall. And we worked that and worked that and worked that. And one of the, I can't remember who it was, I think it was one of the Bonner County deputies, found the tooth that he had knocked out in the pea gravel.
Wow.
After a whole winter in North Idaho. And so Farron was actually able, he was such a weirdo. I think he's passed away now, but so I went to testify at the state hearing, you know, the trial for homicide. And he represented himself.
There's a mistake.
And the judge, and he said, I want to testify. And the judge said, well, you know, maybe you should talk to this attorney in the gallery that might give you some advice. And he said, nope, I'm going to testify. And so they released the jury, you know, they took the jury out, and the judge said, you know, you can testify if you want to, but you're going to have to affirm or swear. And he goes, no, I'm not going to do that. I'll just testify. And the judge said, well, then you got to affirm or swear. You don't have to do it on a Bible, but you got to affirm you're going to tell the truth. And Farron said, well, let's just try it. And so they brought the jury back in. It's a little courtroom in Sandpoint, Idaho. And Farron gets up in front of the jury and he raises his hand and he said, I affirm that I will tell the truth as long as it benefits me. And the judge said, all right, let's see what you got to say. And then he pretty much confessed to everything, but had reasons. And he gave his whole manifesto that was 4 or 5 pages long. The defense rested, the prosecution rested. I mean, they gave their little closing arguments, which was, quick. You know, he did it mostly himself. So they sent the jury to the deliberation room, took Farron to the back, sent the jury to the deliberation room, and the judge, I mean, take the jury. The judge had just stood up, and he looked, and the door had just shut on the jury deliberation room, and the judge said, you know what? It's lunchtime, Mr. Bailiff. Go back and see if you can get their order so that they can, you know, have a lunch, and then they can get on with their duties. And I'm just sitting in the back. So I saw the bailiff, and it's very small, and the door opened, and again, seconds have passed. The door opens and he said, hey, judge wants me to check on your lunch. You need to go ahead and elect a 4-person. And I hear this voice go, we've done that already. And then he says, well, let's go ahead and order your lunch. Do you want sandwiches or pizza? And the 4-person goes, which is quicker? And he said, well, probably sandwiches. And they go, all right, we're not going to be long. And the door shut and they ate pizza and then convicted him of capital murder. It was literally long enough to cook a pizza that they,
we're not laughing. Murder's not funny, but as we know too, it's never a good sign for the defendant when the jury is, when it takes longer to do the paperwork than it does to come up with the verdict. Oh.
Yeah. Exactly. And Farron really, he really is one of those. I have often have, as I'm sure you guys have, people ask me how many, you must have arrested a lot of evil people. You must have come across a lot of evil. And I say, yeah, you know what? There are some evil people out there, but by and large, most of the people, now the evil people were certainly evil. Most of the people were just people that did evil things. But Farron, he was an evil dude. He was involved in a whole bunch of other stuff with the Kehoe brothers, which people can Google Chevy Kehoe and all that.
They got into.
He was a running mate of Chevy. Yeah, well, he was a running mate of the Kehoes in the murder that happened in Arkansas. And the more we dug into Farron Lovelace, the darker and deeper. So when I envision, in writing, the bad guys need to be evil. They need to be very good foils for the, you know, very good foes for the your protagonist. And so I envision a lot of how Farron made me feel when I'm around him, and a handful of others when I'm writing fictional bad guys. But that it felt very good to get Farron off the street, because he was a a danger.
I'm surprised.
Sure.
Why is it that the fact that he admits to the murder tells you how he did it, takes you to where the body buried out in the middle of nowhere? You got to know where it's at. How come you're telling me a prosecutor said that wasn't enough for a conviction?
Yeah, I don't know. I guess they just wanted more.
Well, just prosecutors more. Always want more.
It was I've got many friends that are attorneys as well, but I have my thoughts.
Don't we all?
Well, hey, let's talk about this too, because I want to make sure we get into talking about your books. So, did you start writing like the stuff like the your one that you're doing here now, the Arliss Cutter novels? Did you start writing those while you were still on the Marshal Service? How did your transition go from law enforcement to punching out, you know, and doing this and getting into Tom Clancy?
Yeah, so I wrote a couple of westerns. Because of my background with a horse, you know, as a horseshoer and all that. So I wrote, I thought, you know, I grew up in Texas. Most of my rejection letters were for short stories and things like that. But so I wrote a couple of westerns, and I decided I'm going to go to and I was still with the Marshals, and I decided I was going to go to a, writer's conference for Western writers that focused on Western literature. So I went to a conference in Helena, Montana. At those writers' conferences, a lot of times they'll have like speed dating. You sit down with an editor or agent for 3 or 4 or 5 minutes, pitch your idea, and then move on to the next one. And they either give you a card and say, yeah, send me 3 chapters, or I don't really think this is for us, whatever. Well, anyway, one of the editors there asked me for 3 chapters. And so I sent her the chapters for this Western. And of course, before I did, I sent it to all my friends, you know, FedExed it to all my friends and said, hey, could you look this over for me and really, you know, bleed all over it with the red ink? Because I thought it was ready until somebody really wanted to see it. And then I got terrified. So we fixed those 3 chapters, sent it on. And then it was actually my wife called me, and it was looking back now, it's kind of chuckly, but it was a sad day because my wife called me and she said, her dad was quite old when she was born. And so he was 90 years old. And she said, my father's dying. We need to go to Calgary. And I said, oh man, you know, I loved my father-in-law, just a World War II vet, a fantastic guy. And she said, and they called and they want to publish your book. And so I was like, gosh, this guy I love is passing away, but this is my break, you know? So I'm torn emotionally. So we go to Calgary. We get to talk to my father-in-law, and then he passes away. He's a very, just a wonderful guy. I get on the phone with, Anne at the publisher, and she says, I can't get your book in the publication list because it's going to be like 18 months, 2 years before I can do that. But I do have a book that I need finished. It's by another author. Can you finish that up for me? And it'll be, you know, just be ghostwriting it. And he's a well-known author. We see his books in stores all the time. And I said, yeah, whatever you need me to do, absolutely, I'll do it. So she FedExed me a whole bunch of the books, said, read these over. Tell me if you think, you know, and then we've got to get on this. So I read them over. Absolutely, I can do this. I call back, and the receptionist at the publisher said, I said, I need to speak to Anne. And she said, well, Anne doesn't work here anymore. And I said, oh, well, I'm taking over for this author. And the receptionist said, that's between you and Anne, and hung up the phone. And I was orphaned again. And so, you know, my leave is running out. I'm getting ready to go back come back to Alaska to start back up. And I get an email out of the blue from a literary agent named Robin Rue with Writer's House Literary Agency. And she introduced herself. This is my name. She said, Anne is a friend of mine, and she gave me your pages. I've read them over. I would like to represent you. And so I was like, yes, please. I would love to do that. And so, I ended up getting my literary agent that way. She got me back in with the publisher. I ended up ghostwriting 2 of those books. They published 2 of my own Westerns under the name Mark Henry. And then one day she called me on the phone and said, you know, Mark, I really think you should branch out into thrillers. And so I wrote, you know, because there's not as many people reading Westerns and with your background. So I got permission from the Marshal Service to write as long as I didn't contract myself. In other words, I had to write everything on spec. I couldn't get paid ahead of time because I couldn't be beholden to somebody by contract because of mainly because of availability pay. You have to be available 24/7 to go work. And so I wrote a book, sent it off. She trotted it all around New York. Nobody wanted it. I thought she was going to drop me. But instead she said, we'll do it again, write another one. So I spent another year, wrote another book. And it was about Alaska Native kids and Prince of Wales Island and a murder that the kids saw and some different things. And I sent it off. And again, it didn't seem like anybody wanted it. And then I got Robin, my agent, forwarded me an email with a rejection letter on it, but it was a page and a half long. And it said, really effusive stuff. We like your writing. We like your characters. These are very rich characters. You know, all kinds of good stuff. And then it said, but this is just not marketable for us. You can't figure out whether you want to write a romance or a mystery or whatever. And it gave me some really good advice. But this particular editor, who has no recollection, I'm sure, of sending me this rejection letter, really changed the trajectory of my career, because the last couple of sentences of this page and a half letter says, and anyway, who cares about Alaska? And who cares about a bunch of Alaska Native kids? Write Jason Bourne. Write James Bond. Write over the top. And it pissed me off. I thought, what do you mean, who cares about Alaska? This was pre all the reality shows. This was pre Sarah Palin making the front page. This was nobody really knew that much about Alaska in the early 2000s, late, you know, 90s. And so I went back to work and I wrote this, what I thought was going to be a one-off. About at that time, my son had just graduated the Air Force Academy and was going to be an OSI agent. So I thought, nobody knows about the OSI. I'll make this super OSI agent that speaks several languages. I love Japan and speak Japanese. My son speaks Mandarin. So I put all these different qualities together and made this character named Jericho Quinn, and I ride motorcycles. I ride a BMW GS. At that time, my friend was riding a GS. I thought, that is a cool bike. So I put Jericho on this BMW GS adventure, gave him a bunch of languages, made him an amalgam of all these cool people I've known, including Tommy Norris. And we sold hundreds of thousands of copies. And the book that I thought was going to be a one-off, we've done 8 and 2 novellas. I decided I'm going to dust off. We were doing well enough. We hit the New York Times. We were doing well enough that I asked my agent, I said, I want to do that other book about Alaskan natives and kids and all that. And she said, yeah, I can get you a contract for that, because the Jerichos were doing well enough. And so Kensington, I got a contract for the Cutters, started writing the Cutters. In the meantime, I was at a conference in New Orleans, I think, called BoucherCon, which is a mystery and thriller.
I was going to say, I just got a note. David Baldacci was just down there. He actually lives not too far from me. I've run into him a couple times. He's done book signings and stuff, and he just got back from BoucherCon. Yeah.
BoucherCon, it goes on every year, and it's a really great conference. Obviously, for me, for networking, because I had known Mark Graney a little bit. We had met a couple of times. My wife and I had dinner with him, and I love his Gray Man books. And then he was writing the Clancys at the time, and so we just kind of passed in the hotel one evening, and he said, hey, what are you working on right now? Working on another Jericho? And I said, well, I'm just turning in a Jericho, and I'm starting this new series as well. Still going to do the Jerichos. And he goes, well, hey, before that Jericho comes out, why don't you send me a copy of the manuscript, and I'll give you a cover blurb. Well, any author knows that's the coin of the realm, man, especially from somebody like Mark Graney. And I hate asking for cover quotes. Because I know how busy I am. And I've got, you know, 6 or 7 right now that I'm supposed to get to that I haven't gotten to yet, and I want to. I want to help other writers, but it's just a matter of time, right? So for somebody like Mark to offer, I was, wow, this is cool. So absolutely. So I sent him an e-copy of one of the, you know, the advanced read copies and sent him that. And unbeknownst to me, he was stepping away from the Clancy gig. He had done 7, and he gave that to Tom Colgan at Penguin Random House / Putnam, who does the Tom Clancy's. And I don't know whether I was the second choice or third choice or fifth choice, but whoever else was really good said no. And somehow they got down to me, and they liked the Jericho books. And so I was down in Florida, down on in Port Charlotte area, staying at my barber. My barber has a house down there she goes to in the winter, and she let me stay down there with my wife. And so we were researching the Arliss Cutter book, that the first Arliss Cutter book called Open Carry. And I was on the beach at Manasota Key there looking at shark teeth, and my phone rang, and it was Robin Rue. And she said, Mark Graney's stepping away from the Clancy's, and he has suggested your name. They would like you to write the next Jack Ryan. And my wife, I don't know what she thought was going on, but she knew it was something big, so she took a picture of me. So somewhere deep in my social media, I'm standing in these goofy board shorts and with a straw hat on, and I'm kind of clutching myself, listening to my phone with this stricken look on my face. And I told Robin, I said, well, you know, I've got another Jericho, and I've got this Cutter coming out. I don't know if I have it. And she stopped me. She goes, and she's got this marvelous accent. And she said, Mark, it's Clancy. Don't around. And I said, you're right. Yes, I will do it. I will absolutely do it. And they wouldn't let me talk about it for months and months and months. In fact, I broke the news. My wife and I go to an island in the South Pacific for a couple of months every year and do some writing there. And we have friends. It sounds snooty when I say that, but we have friends there that let us stay at a reduced rate in their little bungalow, but it's a beautiful, beautiful place called Rarotonga. So I was on the beach in Rarotonga, and I took a picture of me in a hammock with the Tom Clancy Companion. You know, I'm reading that, but so it just sort of, I was very fortunate and had good friends and was at the right place at the right time with, you know, a product that the Clancy Estate and Tom Colgan and Mark Graney liked, and was able to sort of segue in and do all those, and been very fortunate.
Nice. That's amazing too, because if I remember right, Ryan's literary agent is John Talbot. John Talbot at one time represented Tom Clancy, if I remember that right. Was one of the first people to represent him.
Yeah, I don't know.
Anyway, I'm just saying Ryan was telling me about that. Yeah, but the literary agent, it's very important. Hey, so let's talk about this too, because we got the advanced reader copy, but it is Arliss Cutter Breakneck. He's a force of nature, but so is the Alaskan wilderness. So this, what I found interesting is because, like I said, my history, my sister was born there. My dad was on the honor guard when Alaska became a state. And just, I've never had a chance to visit it. One of the few states I want to go to that I've never been, but it's just that thought of man, which Arliss Cutter is, you know, man against nature. I mean, it's just like there are very few other epic battles that you can have. Not, there could be bad guys, right? But it's the Alaskan wilderness doesn't give a shit who you are. It treats everybody the same. You know, and I like what you were just saying too. So tell us about this, but tell us about the research you were just doing, because you just got in your time late last night. You're 4 hours behind us from doing research for your next book. So you, like you said, you're out in a village. So tell us about this. Tell us about Breakneck, and then let's talk about what you're working on.
Yeah, so Breakneck is the fifth in the Arliss Cutter series. And what I try to do, Arliss Cutter is a supervisory deputy marshal running the Alaska Fugitive Task Force, which is a multi-agency, it's a real task force, a multi-agency task force made up of usually, and it fluctuates, but we've had DEA helping us out. We've had even a part-time FBI agent. We have ATF agents. We have APD, Anchorage Police Department, Alaska State Troopers, and some are on part-time, some are on full-time, but we generally have a full-time trooper, full-time Anchorage Police, and then the feds kind of, as they have enough personnel, they'll send people over, and sometimes state parole will come over because they have arrest authority, and so work together to get these bad guys off the street. It makes for a really good milieu to plunk my characters in, to, because Alaska is a place that, as you mentioned, it's pretty dangerous. We have a bumper stickers up here that say "Step out of the RV and into the food chain," and it's just a wild place. And in fact, you mentioned I just got back from a place that used to be called Barrow, Alaska. In fact, the airport is still Barrow, the Wiley Post, Will Rogers Wiley Post. That's where they crashed in their airplane. They've gone back to the native name, which is Utqiagvik. So when I say I was in Utqiagvik, that's because that's what they call it now. But, when you get to the hotel, there's a big sign on the door saying, be bear aware, there's polar bears out here, you know, watch for polar bears. And they, you know, sometimes come into town. And I went to rent my little beat up Ford Escape rental car, and it's covered with mud. And when it's not snowy there, it's muddy. It's either really dusty or really muddy. It's like an old frontier town. I just like the feel of being out there. But when I rented the car, the guy showing the rental car said, "Hey, out at the edge of town, they just saw a big fat polar bear," and he showed me a video. And this polar bear was the size of a Volkswagen, I mean, or probably a Mini Cooper. It's a big polar bear, just rolling along and pretty fat on seals and probably some caribou. And the guy that I was with, who works with the school districts, he helped me a lot with research, and he's lived up there. And so we were driving around on the edge of town, and right at the edge of town, this polar bear's got a caribou down, and it's just covered in mud and laying out on the tundra, just munching down on the. And we were literally in the middle of, there was no one else around. We were 2 miles out of town. It would have been a long, and I should say 2 miles out of town. It was in between town and the high school football field. So 2 miles, you know, a mile and a half either direction. It would have been a very long walk for that polar bear within 100.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Because polar bears, they're not like brown bears or black. We call a grizzly a brown bear in Alaska, but they're not like grizzlies or black bears in that you could play bit dead or fight it off or whatever. Polar bears, for one thing, there's no trees to climb. But for the other thing, polar bears consider humans food. So they don't run away from you unless they think they're being hunted. But they actually actively stalk you as food. Ooh. So polar bears are pretty dangerous. So that's just an example of the wilderness. But beyond that, I remember my editor early on in the Cutter books, he said, "How come you've always, you know, you can't do the storm thing anymore? There can't be a storm isolating everybody. Why you got another storm?" I said, "Well, we just call that Tuesday here in Alaska, because that's just the way it is. It's not uncommon at all. In fact, last night even we'd been there 3 nights, and we're watching the weather, just hoping, because the fog would roll in. If the fog's there, the airplanes circle around just long enough to know they got enough fuel to get back to Anchorage, then they leave. And so I've been stranded in Barrow, Utqiagvik many times. I've been stranded out on the coast, the western Alaska coast, by the Bering Sea, by fog and snow and rain, and down in southeast Alaska and in Kodiak. There's just so many ways that the moose, right after I first moved here, this is in 98. And so I was working the task force when I first moved here, and with APD, and we had a guy that was in a house, was had barricaded, and we tried to make the arrest. He barricaded, so we had APD with their MP5s, and there was a couple of deputies, and we had the house surrounded, and the houses were pretty close together, but there are easements through the houses for wild animals and for kids to go to school and sort of walk to the bus stops. Jeez. And so I'm like pressed up against the window where the bad guy is behind me inside, and we can hear the negotiators talking. So we've got the four points of the house, watching the house. So I'm this way near a bollard that I think I was by a chimney. So I wasn't worried about getting hit in the back. And I hear one of the APD guy, Anchorage police guys, kind of kitty cornered from me by the fence. And he goes, and he's kind of standing up with his MP5. And I hear him go like that, kind of, hey, heads up, everybody. And we all looked over, and this mama moose that had to be 7 feet tall at the withers come, and her ears are pinned back, her hackles are up, and she's got, I moved up in April, so this would have been around May. So all the babies are just hitting the ground. So she's got these two brand new chocolate brown baby moose, and she is on guard, and she's marching right through all the police officers outside, just daring us. And I could have reached out and scratched her ribs. I mean, she was that close. She just came by. So I'm like snuck up, again, you know, squished up against the house. It's just by the grace of God, I didn't get stomped to pudding that day. So moose, avalanche, bears, volcanoes, we've had deputies fall through the ice, you know, just up to their knees. But if you're chasing somebody and you fall through the ice up to your knees and it's 17 below, you're done. You go back to the car, and or if you keep chasing, you lose your toes, right? So there's just so many, and I absolutely love it. There's just, you know that, you know, it's a big thing with, and I'm a gun guy. I'm a Second Amendment guy, but everybody up here,
is. Yeah,
you need to have a gun on. You need to have a gun on. When you go out to the, if I go hiking with my grandkids, I got a 44 Magnum Smith & Wesson here, not somewhere in my pack or not stuck down underneath my belt or even my shirt. It is here. And there's just just to go out to take the garbage out. We haven't ever had any problems. We have black bears in our yard all the time. And then just up the road, like within less than a mile. In fact, I just got a Facebook post last week about 4 miles from my house. This lady posted that, hey, if anybody hears shots, a grizzly bear just chased a black bear up a tree and killed it and buried it, you know, in my front yard. So be careful when you're walking around out here. So now add that to hunting fugitives. And, you know, I remember times when we would go out and even for tracking training, because we do a lot of man tracking stuff up here. I talk like I'm still doing it. We did a lot of man tracking stuff up here, and we would have the rabbit, you know, the FBI agent or National Guard or whoever, you know, we'd be training other agencies. They'd be off at the rabbit run ahead, and then the other agency people that were trained would go ahead of them. And we'd be in contact by radio, and we'd be their tracks. We'd see the rabbit's tracks, you know, the quarry, the fugitive, see the tracks. And on top of those tracks, we'd see like a 11-inch, 12-inch, 14-inch bear track that's filling with water as we're standing there. And so, you know, we're like calling them like, hey, you got company coming up behind you. And when you're out there like that, an MP, you know, a 9mm or an M4 with a 20-round mag of 223 ammo looks awfully puny when you're looking at a brown bear. I remember being up on a tracking mission where I was the primary tracker up really just a little north of where I live. There was a Dall sheep hunter that had gone missing. We got called in to track for search and rescue as well as fugitives. And this Dall sheep hunter had gone missing. And the last he had been seen, the troopers had landed on him in their helicopter, and he was way up in the mountains. They'll be talking to a hunter. You might have seen something like this on Alaska State Troopers, but they'll be talking to one hunter, and that hunter will say, well, I heard a shot over there, and, you know, they check his or her paperwork. And so the helicopter flew over. They landed on this hunter. He had the doll sheep down. He had all his paperwork right. And he'd already been up in the mountains like four or five days. And so this the sheep is down. He was out of water at this spot because his spike camp is further up the mountain. So the troopers gave him some water and said, "Are you doing okay?" He said, "Yeah, I'm doing fine. I just appreciate the water." Since his license is okay, they flew away. And then he didn't show up again at home for 4 days. And he should have been home like late the next night or possibly the next. And so a better part of a week in, there's a place called the Peters Creek Drainage. A better part of a week in, they asked us to come in and we had what they call a point last seen or a last known point. Different trackers call it a certain thing. We called it a last known point. A point last seen. So they took me out by helicopter, put me in that place where we knew that he had been seen. And if you can imagine, you guys ever plowed with a Troy-built tiller? You know, when you go over dirt with a tiller or something like that? So this sheep gut pile had been there and all the blood and all that. The bears had come in after he had left, and it just looked like it had been tilled. The whole side of the mountain, there was no hair. There was no, you could tell, I guess I saw like a tuft of white hair, but there was no bone, and you bone out. You don't want to carry that off a mountain, so there should have been bones and stuff there. I could tell this was a kill site, but the bears had just eaten the dirt and pooped the dirt. They had just done everything. But I was able to, what they asked me to do was backtrack from there and find his spike camp. So I was able to go through the mountains and found his spike camp and then there was snow in the high country, so we were able to. Most of the time, trackers don't find the lost person. We give azimuths to the people that are on the ground and air assets looking. So I was able to say, it looks like he went this way. There's some aged snow, and so I'm giving out that information, but I'm on this point of land. It's basically where the peak of the mountain comes off, and it was not a hard climb. It was a decent climb, but I got halfway up there by helicopter, right? But it's just beautiful. And at that point, I was carrying, because I was doing so much hiking, carrying what we in the Marshall Service call a Witsec shotgun. It's that little short 870. They sell them now called a TAC 14, I think. It's got a 14-inch barrel. This one has like a 11 and a half or 12 inch barrel, but a bird's head grip and really short shotgun. And it fit in a scabbard right by my pack. So I could carry that for bear protection. And then I also had my just regular pistol. At that point, I think they were making us carry Glocks. So I was carrying my Glock 40. So I wanted to have my 12 gauge with Brennecke slugs in it. So I had that little 12 gauge and I'm sitting on this and I had the satellite phone and I'm straddling. So one leg is in one valley, one leg is in the other valley. It's just this beautiful vista with glaciers. And I called my chief and I'm talking to her. Here's what's happening. I think they're going to find him down this wash. And I look across and there was beaters. There was people on four wheelers and horses down in the valley. And this, so just on the mountain, so not on my side, but on the mountain across from me, so maybe 100, 150 meters away, this brown bear sow comes rolling out of the – and I know she was a sow because there was a cub that kind of splintered off and went another way. She comes roaring out of the pucker brush, all this alder and stuff like that on the bottom, and just fat rolling off of her. And, it's fall time, so she's – bulking up for the winter, and she's running up a mountain that's like your kitchen wall almost, and it's not slowing her down at all. And I remember thinking, this gun is not big enough. I need something I can put to my shoulder so I can hold it steady when this bear comes after me. And I, at that time, I started carrying a 375 H&H Magnum. I was done with shotguns.
Say in the words of a famous captain on a boat, we're going to need a bigger boat. Like, you're going to need a bigger gun. It's just not going to be enough for this.
Oh yeah. Yeah, exactly. They always say you don't need a big gun. You just need a .22 so you can shoot your buddy in the knee and then run off and leave him for the bear.
That was the old joke we used to tell out camping, insert your favorite state, but guy from Kansas, guy from Maine out camping, bear attacks a campsite. Guy from Kansas running around screaming, "Oh my God, we got to go." Guy from Maine putting on his shoes. Guy goes, Kansas goes, "What are you doing? You can't outrun a bear." Don't have to outrun the bear, just have to outrun you.
That's right.
Yeah, exactly. That's told quite often around the campfire. So I try to put, and we have so many isolated places. So in this particular, in Breakneck, for instance, there's some polar bear stuff up in Utqiagvik. Part of the action takes place. The front of the book is the barrow arches, or the whalebone arches that overlook the Arctic Ocean. And if anybody looks on my social media, just Mark Cameron, you'll see me day before yesterday standing with a copy of that book in front of those arches, and it's about 34 degrees and the wind's blowing sideways. So I try to put in the native culture that's in that area, because that's predominantly who it is. It's Inupiaq people up there. On Western Alaska, it's Yupik people, interior, it's Athabascan. But so I try to put in that stuff. In this particular book, in Breakneck, there's the action happens up in Utqiagvik, out by the bright blue football field. There's so much culture and so much different out there, with some whales. And in fact, I've got some whale in my fridge right now that we got up in Utqiagvik, some muktuk and also some, they call it fermented whale, but I think it's just controlled putrefaction, but it's safe to eat. It's a way. So when I write it, I can explain, we eat cheese, so, blue cheese, but it's not something that I would serve to guests or anything, but it's nice to know when I write what it smells like and tastes like, that I can feel the fizziness on my tongue and explain that to people.
You can feel the bile coming up from your system when you're throwing up.
Yeah, exactly. The muktuk, I enjoy. The other was acquired taste. And I don't, I don't like to make fun of other people's food. It's what they had to do to survive. But the muktuk is actually good. I like, it's the skin and the blubber. And you can slice that really thin and eat it with soy sauce and whatnot. It's sushi. The skin is actually very thick, and it's like a rubber tire. It gets in your teeth. So there's that. There's the interior of Alaska and a train that goes into remote parts of the country that my wife and I have taken the trains. And I try to keep up with my – I'm not a big buy my book on social media. What I do try to do is give my readers who are already there some added value by saying, hey, take a look at the research I did for Breakneck, or in the new book that's coming up, it's called Bad River. Take a look at the research I'm doing for Bad River, so you can kind of look for those sorts of things in the book. So that's fun. I get to travel around Alaska and meet old friends that I knew from when I was with the Marshall Service and went to all these places.
I just looked up Barrow, Alaska on Google Maps here. That's like the farthest point north in Alaska, isn't it?
It is. It is the farthest point in the United States north. And that's where I was standing. That Point Barrow is right out the road from the city of Barrow or Utqiagvik. You drive out, and the point's right out there. It's a fascinating place. Absolutely fascinating.
We're going to reach out and see if we can find some type of psychologist or something to see if we can get you some help, Mark.
The first step in recovery is asking for help. Yeah.
Yeah. Well,
hey, good man, luck. I got to tell you, this is what's been so fun about this. Again, this is why you write such great books. Is to write a great book, you got to be a great storyteller. And one of the advantages of being in law enforcement, right, is you can't make this shit up. I mean, we do a whole thing on Patreon, but it's called You Can't Make This Shit Up. And some of the stories, some of the stuff, if you told it, it's kind of like, there's no way that happened. It's like, yeah, that happened. It's like, even the embarrassing stuff, it's so much fun. So no more Tom Clancy. You're going to focus on Arliss. Why? Last question here, because we want to be respectful of your time. But the Jericho and the Arliss, are you going to keep those both going, or does one have to stop so you can focus on the other? I mean, because it's a lot of cognitive load, like you said. I mean, to write a book and do the research, it's not like you can kind of do half of something today, half of one on the other one tomorrow. I mean, it's almost like when you get into something, at least for me, I got to stay immersed in it so that I don't lose track of where I'm at. How does that work for you?
No, I write. I write one thing at a time generally, but I can still go back and forth. And I'll write. I get people asking me about when the next Jericho is coming out all the time. I get several emails a day. I got one just before I logged on with you guys. I just got another one asking if I would quit writing the Jerichos, and I have not. I have one plotted out. It's just that the publisher and I have decided that it's, and you know, it's really up to them what books they want me to write and publish, because I have to make my living at this. And I enjoy writing the Jerichos. I enjoy writing the Jerichos. I enjoy writing the Cutters. Eventually, hopefully before too long, there'll be another Jericho, but I'll go back. I have contracts for another Jericho and a couple more. We just signed for two more Arliss Cutters. So, but I'll write one for 6-7 months and then go back and write another one, but you know, back and forth. But these are, I'm one of those guys that, you know, you're right. I do need some sort of psychological help, because my wife and I were joking, you know, what if we won the lottery? She said, what would you do? And I said, well, I guess I would just keep writing until all the money was gone. I might write one book a year instead of two, but I just enjoy writing. It's my catharsis. Obviously I do, because I wrote for 25 years, almost every night before, you know, and on, you know, deadheading back on prisoner trips. And I had a college professor get me aside one time, because he saw that I was wasting my time flirting with the girls and procrastinating and all that. And he pulled me aside and he said, you know, Mark, you are going to amount to something if you can stop acting this way. And he said, you will never amount to your full potential unless you learn to utilize those 15-minute segments of time that everybody else wastes. And I really took him to heart. So when I would be, like yesterday, we were at the airport, and Barrow Airport is this tiny little airport with like 14 seats. And when somebody arrives and people are leaving, you're all kind of run into one another. And so we got there a little bit early, and I spent 2 hours working on Bad River in the Barrow Airport, because I had the time. And where, you know, friends of mine that like video games or online poker or whatever, that's what they do, and good on them. That's their deal. It's enjoyable to me to get in that, like you were saying, that kind of, I get in kind of a fugue state, and my wife has to sometimes throw something at me to get me to, you know, come out.
It kind of goes back to the old saying too, that if you find a job you like, you'll never work a day in your life.
Oh, you're absolutely right. And I think I could probably end on this if you guys are ready to go. But I get asked a lot, especially at writing gigs, because I'm arguably fairly successful at this. We've hit bestseller lists and we're selling well. I'm able to travel and all of that. And I get asked all the time, man, what is it like to have your dream job? And I every time, or the best job in the world. And I say, you know what? This is the second best job in the world. There's not a day that goes by that I don't miss the people of the Marshal Service and the mission. I don't miss the politics, but I miss the people and the mission. And I already had the best career that I could have ever hoped for. I loved going to work, loved my job. And now I am so supremely blessed to get this whole nother career that's the readers that I get to meet, the people I get to go back and research for the Clancys or the Cutters or the Jerichos. I don't want to get all weepy, but I've got a lot of gratitude because I get to keep my toe in the water with the SWAT team here. One of the guys that's one of the snipers on the SWAT team here called me the other day and said, hey, I got some stories for you. Let's go walking at the track. Who gets to do that? I mean, my son's not there. Maybe he's just calling me and saying, I want you to feel relevant, old man. Let's come, let's walk around with me. But who gets to keep their toe in the water with law enforcement when they're 61 years old and get to hear the war stories and get to go hang out with the SWAT guys or fly around in a V-22 with the Marine Corps? Because I write silly books. I
just got to watch those Ospreys, guy. Man.
I really am. And talk to you guys. Hey, I get to talk to you guys. Hey, I'm too old to die tragically young. I can fly an Osprey whenever
there
I
you
want.
Go. I got to tell you, I've started supporting the. I live in Orlando, Florida, and I've started supporting the Orlando Police and their police foundation. And through that, they have the annual SWAT competition, the SWAT Roundup. So I've already gotten an invitation this November to come out to the SWAT Roundup, which is right here in Orlando with teams all over the United States and several teams from other countries come in for competition, man. I can't wait. I'm excited.
Isn't that wonderful to see that? It gives you hope for the future. I wanted to have in the last Clancy and two Clancys ago, because the second to the last one was set in 1985, so it's kind of a throwback. But Chain of Command and Command and Control, which is my last one, they both feature a young Abilene PD SWAT officer. And I wanted it to be APD because all my buddies here, my son's buddies with Anchorage PD, so I could write APD. And I could sort of swipe some of their names, the name characters and all that. So I flew out to Fort Worth and drove to Abilene and worked with just cold called them on email, and they said, yeah, come on out. I was out there with Abilene PD and Abilene PD SWAT. Stellar. And it just does my heart good to see these young men and women that are the future and, you know, the present and the future. And we, I think guys our age, we have a tendency to go, these kids today, but man, I'm pretty proud of these people that I get to meet.
Absolutely. We had two Orlando officers shot here about 6 weeks ago, and fortunately both are recovering, and the jerk that pulled the trigger is in the ground now where he belongs. But I had the honor, and I'm still shocked that this even happened, that there's a lieutenant down there I'm good buddies with, John Cute, and John said, hey, would you come in and talk to the SWAT and the tactical squads, you know, just tell them your little story. We're going to hold a little luncheon here, we'll cater in, you know, Panera or whatever, and you know, get up in 45, 60 minutes, just tell them your story. And here's, I've been retired now for 10 years. I was a cop for 38 years, but to have the honor to stand in front of these young studs, these young men and women who are out there so proud to be wearing the badge, so proud to be wearing police on their clothing, you know, it's just a true honor. Just, and you know, they're probably looking at me like I'm an idiot because I'm fangirling over these guys. And you know, they're like, well, we want to hear your story. I'm like, dude, I want to hear what'd you do last night? What happened? Just tell me.
Well, I got a really important question for you, though. Will we see Jericho and Arliss ever team up in the future?
You know, I don't know. It's such a different world. The Jericho books are, I always like to say, they're possible but not plausible. Think of the Jerichos as Jason Bourne. And I mean, he is, everything he does can be done on his motorcycles or, you know, whatever, but it's almost a different universe. But it's funny you mention that because my editor has sort of teased that idea, but I don't know. We'll see. It would be there is a deputy marshal in the Jericho books named August Bowen that is kind of a blueprint of Arliss Cutter, but then when I spun him off, it grew quite a bit from my August Bowen into Arliss Cutter. So if you read maybe like the fifth Jericho on, there's a character in there that might be pretty reminiscent of Arliss Cutter. His name's Gus
All
Bowen.
Right. Well,
very cool.
And folks, you can find him too, markcameronbooks.com. That's correct, right? Markcameronbooks.com?
It's Mark, M-A-R-C, yep. Not M-A-R-K.
M-A-R-C.
M-A-R-C, yep. Yep, Mark, on the website or on social media or anything like that.
Because somebody posted a picture. They went to Starbucks and they spelled his name. I said, my name's Mark with a C. So that's what they wrote on there. They wrote M-A-R-K with a C. That's his name.
Oh, or sometimes they'll do it Kark.
Kark.
They'll write Kark, like Kark. Mark with a C, Kark. You know, I've got to say, let me just say one thing. You guys, it's been a pleasure to talk to you. Because I kind of fangirl on my other, you know, just my fellow officers. I got to tell you, as a father of law enforcement, my son was in a officer-involved shooting. After the shooting, who did I hear from? Who did he hear from? All my buddies. all my people that I knew that closed ranks around him, and it very literally brought tears to my eyes. And this was several years ago, but that I didn't just talk about or pay lip service to, or none of us paid lip service to, that we're a family, because guys like you, people that I've even met just tangentially, saw on the news, called, hey, how's it going? What's going on? And not to ask questions, but let me help you out. Let me give him, like you, Steve, talking about your experiences and how that helps some of these young guys. It's pretty moving. So being able to chat with you, obviously my publishers will get mad if I say this, but I don't care about my books. I love my books. I love writing. I hope people buy my books. But talking to you about law enforcement and sharing stories, this made my day.
And this is how we keep our foot in the door too. Once we said this in our Patreon episode a little earlier today, that we're like the mafia. Once you're in the family, there's only one way out.
There's only one way out, this thing of arms. And I got to tell you, when we first started, I thought you were going to be a little shy, pull it out. And then it's like, when we start talking, no, let me tell you, and this is the great part, is when you can just, we've had some guests, they're good, they got good stories, but you got to, okay, come on, throw a little more out there, But with you, it's like, this was so much fun to sit back and just listen to the stories, being told. So hey, this is, first of all, this is us saluting you. Number one, thank you for Weatherford. Thank you for being a U.S. Marshal. We had some friends in common. Always good to talk with people like that. But what I love is thank you for writing what you're doing, because you portray law enforcement in a positive light, and that's something that's needed today. People don't realize how tough this job is. It's tougher than when probably you and I and everybody else were on the job. It is much tougher today, and thank you for doing that. And look, I got to tell you, man, you've inspired me. Like I said, I'm finished. I'm just doing the final pass, polishing grammar and stuff, and I'm turning it over and I'm starting. You've got me psyched up now. I'm like, I'm getting on this, man. I've got more time behind me than I have ahead of me, so I got to get going. So thank you for doing that for me too.
Well, it's been a true honor to have you on here. Thanks for sharing your stories. We will promote your books out till the day we die. Wishing you continued success, and that of your son also, for going into law enforcement. So God bless you both.
All right, you bet. All right, thank you.
You guys don't go anywhere. Everybody hang on for just a second. All of you guys, stay tuned for the debrief. Just the story about how they were out there trying to arrest a guy and the moose just comes wandering through there, Just things that are uniquely Alaskan you have to appreciate.
Well, and Mark just said he backed up against the wall next to the chimney, hoping he wouldn't be noticed. I think I'd have been running out of there screaming like a little girl, there's a big moose going to get me. Somebody help me.
And then bears. And then you hop out and there's bears all over the place. So he's in a perfect place to be writing his books. It was great too. The other thing I loved about it too, you heard him say at the end of it, he said he really enjoyed it, which we did too. It's like sitting around having a beer, or in your case, a ginger ale, you snitch. You have to go back and read what it means.
Spill coffee.
But you have to understand, it's a great compliment from somebody like him he's gotten to the point now to where they take a couple months, they go to a very fantastic little tropical island, way out in the South Pacific, so he can write books. What a great way to, continue on the career. But we had the stories, though. But the one that impacted him, talking about the guy, the killing that he did, and the work they did to go out and find a single tooth in an area, just to find a single tooth. If you want to know, folks, what the definition of dedication is, it's something like that.
One thing that cops like to do, and I think the reason that so many people like Game of Crimes, is cops like to drink beer and tell war stories. And that's what we do here on Game of Crimes. We have the professionals, the heroes who actually live these events, come on and tell you their story. It's not us reading something and then we tell you what their story is. We bring them on so you hear it from the horse's mouth, so to speak, here.
Or the moose's mouth in this case.
Yeah. But, Mark he went a step further, and we actually went longer than we anticipated on his interview, because he has so many stories and we were just scratching the surface. But since then, he's introduced us to two more people we're going to have on the show. One a former CIA case officer and the other retired DEA agent. And let me just say, the DEA agent, his last name is Rambo.
Now, you cannot write a better script for a podcast or a movie, Rambo.
Yep. And we've already got these guys lined up for interviews, so you'll be hearing from them in the future. But, you know, Mark didn't have to go out of the way to do that for us. And so, Mark, thank you so much for coming on the show, and thank you for the introductions. And, I mean, we just wish you continued success. You heard Mark talk about his son went into law enforcement. Now he's over at State Department. So we wish him all safety in that position as he travels around the world. But God bless you, brother. Thanks for coming on the show.
Yeah. And remember, guys, go to Mark, M-A-R-C, Cameron, markcameronbooks.com. And that'll list, and we'll also put a link to his website too. You'll find all of his socials. You can find him on socials. So make sure you go follow him. Make sure you get his book, Breakneck, an Arliss Cutter novel. He's also got Jericho Quinn, in addition to writing the Tom Clancy novel. So what a prolific writer and a great guest. So this is us thanking you. And if you guys enjoyed this episode as much as we did, head on over to Apple, Spotify, hit those 5 stars. It's magic. We don't know how it works. It's like moose. It's like finding a moose in the middle of the Alaska wilderness. Such a treat. Just hit those 5. I don't know how this relates to it, but I just wanted to put one more moose tie in. So I'll also head on over to GameOfCrimesPodcast.com. That's where we have all the information on Mark's book, the rest of our show. Follow us on that thing they call social media, at Game of Crimes on Twitter, Game of Crimes Podcast on Facebook and the Instagram. But guys, you got to go over to Patreon.com/Game of Crimes. That's where we have a ton of fun. Our Q&A is coming up. If you guys haven't listened to that, we take all questions. We answer all things. 911, what's your emergency? The strangest call ever played on a podcast is coming up. You just got to listen to that. Case of the month. We just got through doing Warden of the Throne. So lots of good stuff. And even Murph, the best part about this was we didn't even interrupt. We kept recording, even though Murph spilled coffee all over everything and had to have Connie come in with paper towels to wipe his ass up. I mean, not wipe his ass, but wipe
mess.
His mess up.
Wipe my,
I'm sorry.
Wipe my mess up. Yeah. And thank you, Connie. Love you, girl.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much. Well, hey, guys. Thank you guys joining us once again and helping us play the biggest, baddest, most dangerous game of all and moose-friendly Game of Crimes.
Into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system, so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.